Well, thank you for your welcome and for coming here this morning as well to be part of this morning's conference. Now, before I really begin the material proper, I want to say two things, if I may. First of all, I'm very grateful for John's prayer just now because, of course, I am deeply aware that in the words of his prayer, this is for all of us a difficult and painful subject. I imagine, I'm sure it's true in a group of this size, that amongst us here are those who ourselves are divorced and some of us remarried. And therefore, the question that we're looking at today is one that has painful memories for us, perhaps still very fresh. Fresh perhaps because they happened recently, or fresh because they happened a long time ago, but these things can easily be brought up again in a painful way. Just this week I was talking to a member of our church family, and actually the wife in a remarried situation where the husband was divorced some at least 20 years ago. And they are very happily married, deeply committed Christians. And yet an incident actually to do with the children of the first marriage suddenly has brought up all sorts of old guilt and pain and bitterness all over again. And therefore, as I say, I'm well aware that though for some present here perhaps your divorce is many, many, many years in the past now, a morning like this can scratch at old wounds and make for new pain. I'm grateful to you for having the courage to come to a session like this morning. I certainly don't want in any way to add to your own pain, and ask your forgiveness in advance if that is something which unwittingly I do this morning. But while perhaps those who are divorced and remarried are in a minority here this morning, I'm sure that a majority of us are personally affected by divorce or remarriage. Perhaps some of us are in parents' marriages dissolved. And for many of us here, we have children, brothers, sisters, people who are close to us, neighbors and friends whose marriages have broken up. And therefore, I'm particularly aware of this in the first session because I imagine that one thing that we have in common is that we all want to look at what Jesus had to say first of all. We all want to take our understanding of marriage, divorce, remarriage from Christ himself and from the New Testament. And that's what we'll be looking at in this first session. But I'm also aware that even as I speak on those subjects and as we look at the biblical passage, there's enormous pastoral questions and implications will be coming up for you. I hope we'll be able to cover that, particularly in the second session and in our time of questions. Now, what I'm planning to do, and this has in part been explained by John anyway, is that in this first, we've got an hour from now, I'm going to be looking specifically at the biblical passages and seeking to answer one question in particular, and that is, what does the Bible have to say about remarriage? That is, of course, remarriage, and I will be using that term remarriage as a shorthand consistently for this, remarriage during the lifetime of your divorced partner. Now, I know in the original publicity about this morning conference, it was described simply as divorce. And it's not really on the question of divorce that I am intending to concentrate. Of course, it's impossible to speak about remarriage without speaking about divorce. Impossible to speak about both without speaking about marriage. And so, of course, I will be talking about Christ's and the New Testament's teaching about divorce. But that's not where my emphasis is going to be. And the reason for that is that amongst Christians, The New Testament teaching of divorce is, I think, fairly well understood and not particularly contentious. Not the teaching. The practice, of course, is another thing. And again, we'll be thinking about that in the second session. But I think in the whole area of the New Testament's teaching about remarriage, that is much less well understood by Christians in general, far less frequently discussed, because it is such a difficult subject, and also I think it is a more contentious issue in general. So it's that field that we'll be looking at, and as I say, in this first section I will be looking at the Bible's teaching on that. I hope to finish about 10 o'clock, so that we can have the last quarter of an hour for questions on the specific area of the Bible's teaching. After the break, we'll be looking at the pastoral implications of all this. And again, I hope that I will finish in good time to have plenty of questions at the end of that second session. So, what does the Bible have to say about remarriage? The first point I want to make is this: that the Bible assumes the practice of remarriage. It never recommends it. It never even directly legislates for it. But it does assume it. Now, in order that you shouldn't have to be constantly turning up your own Bibles, I have put on your seats, so if you'd like to take this into your hand, a copy of the main biblical passages on divorce and remarriage. And perhaps you turn now to the first page and to number 2 to show you this fact that the Bible assumes the practice of remarriage. First, I want to show you that from the Old Testament and read Deuteronomy 24, verses 1 to 4. This, incidentally, all these, the version I'm using here is the New International Version. So verse 1, if a man marries a woman who becomes displeasing to him because he finds something indecent about her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce, gives it to her and sends her from his house, and if after she leaves his house she becomes the wife of another man, and her second husband dislikes her and writes her a certificate of divorce, gives it to her and sends her from his house, or if he dies, then her first husband, who divorced her, is not allowed to marry her again after she has been defiled. That would be detestable in the eyes of the Lord. Do not bring sin upon the land the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance. Now you see there in verse 2 of that passage, if after she leaves her first husband's house, she becomes the wife of another man. Now let's be clear about this. This is in no sense a legislation for remarriage. It's actually a legislation to restrict the right of remarriage in a certain rather specific circumstance. It's legislation that forbids remarriage. But it is legislation which assumes the practice of remarriage. And while it speaks negatively of the situation the woman finds herself in, verse 4 is a difficult verse, and unless you ask me a lot about it afterwards, I don't intend to go into it in great detail here. But it says that for some reason or another, the woman who finds herself in this situation, that is of being divorced and remarried, is, verse 4, defiled, and that because she has been defiled, or in some way to do with that and her second marriage in this specific situation would be detestable in the eyes of the Lord, and would bring sin upon the land. So, there is all sorts of negative language in Deuteronomy 24, 1-4, used in connection with divorce and remarriage, at least in this specific circumstance. Nevertheless, the piece of legislation here assumes the practice of remarriage. What is perhaps less well known is that the New Testament also assumes the practice of remarriage. And for this, would you please turn to page 3 and to the bottom passage there, which I've labeled 4b from the Sermon on the Mount. And I'll just read verses 31 and 32, Jesus speaking. It has been said, anyone who divorces his wife must give her a certificate of divorce. But I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife, except for marital unfaithfulness, causes her to commit adultery. And anyone who marries a divorced woman commits adultery. Now, what he seems to be saying here is that a man who divorces his wife causes her, we'll leave aside the exception clause in a moment, because that is clearly an exception clause saying that there is a situation in which it is appropriate for him, or permissible for him, rather, to divorce his wife. But by divorcing your wife, you cause her to commit adultery. That is, you cause her to remarry. The assumption is that the divorced woman, who of course was in a much more precarious situation in both Old and New Testament times than a divorced woman would be in today, the assumption is that she will remarry. Now, while that situation is assumed, it is not approved of. Jesus does not say anyone who divorces his wife causes her to remarry, which would be a morally neutral phrase. He says causes her to commit adultery, which is very far from being a morally neutral phrase. What Jesus actually is saying here is that remarriage is, in his eyes, adultery, something which we will see he says again and again. But the blame for her remarriage does not lie at the woman's door, but at the door of the man who illegitimately divorced her in the first place. But you see again, the assumption is that in the society of Jesus' day, remarriage would be taking place, assumed but not approved of. So that's the first thing I want to say. The Bible, in both Old and New Testament, assumes the practice of remarriage. Secondly, the Old Testament allows remarriage but restricts it. Now, the Old Testament is far from being full of legislation about remarriage. Indeed, as I've said already, it never specifically legislates for remarriage. On the contrary, its only legislation is to restrict remarriage. I've already read the most famous example of this on page 1. I won't read it again. Deuteronomy 24, verses 1 to 4. Which restricts the right to remarriage in a very unusual situation. A situation in which there has been a first marriage, then there's a divorce. The woman, of course, in Old Testament times, only in Jewish society, not in Roman society in the New Testament, but in Jewish society in both Old and New Testament times, only the man had the right to divorce. So the man divorces his wife, she remarries, she's then again divorced or bereaved, And in that circumstance, this legislation says, she may not return to her first husband. So here is a piece of legislation restricting the right of remarriage. There's similar legislation, I haven't put this down here, and if you want to turn it up, of course, please do, which restricts the right of, in fact, forbids the right to marry a divorcee in the case of priests and of the high priest. The references for this are Leviticus 21, verses 5 to 7 in the case of priests, and in verses 13 to 15, same chapter, in the case of the high priest. And in both instances, there are a list of people whom the priest and the high priest are not to marry. And one of those people, in both instances, is a divorcee. So the Old Testament, by implication, allows remarriage, never legislates for it, but by implication allows it, but forbids it, in other words, restricts its availability in a number of specific items of legislation. The New Testament forbids remarriage. Jesus consistently calls it adultery. If you turn on now perhaps again to page 3, and I've deliberately put the two most important passages in Mark 10 and Matthew 19, which John read for us as we came in parallel, so that you, Mark on the left, Matthew on the right, so that you can compare and contrast their accounts of this interview of Jesus's. But let's look first of all at Mark 10, verses 10 and 11. When they were in the house again, the disciples asked Jesus about what he'd said about divorce. And Jesus goes on, he's only been asked about divorce, he goes on, as he frequently does, to open up the question of remarriage. And he says, verse 11, anyone who divorces his wife and marries another woman commits adultery against her. And if she divorces her husband, this is possible under Roman law, and marries another man, she commits adultery. An almost identical saying in Matthew 19, verse 9, just in the opposite column, but with a significant change. I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife except for marital unfaithfulness and marries another woman commits adultery. Now, if we may, we will come back to the vital question of what that exception clause implies a little later on in this first lecture. At the moment, I want simply to establish that Jesus consistently calls remarriage adultery. So we've seen that already in the next quotation in Matthew 5, verse 32. This actually is all part of Jesus' explanation of verse 27, what it means when God says, do not commit adultery. And he says, verse 32, I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife, except for marital unfaithfulness, causes her to commit adultery. And anyone who marries a divorced woman himself commits adultery. So we've looked at Mark and Matthew, and now over the page at Luke. And here an isolated saying of Jesus on remarriage. Verse 18, anyone who divorces his wife and marries another woman commits adultery, and the man who marries a divorced woman commits adultery. So it's Jesus himself who brings up the question of remarriage, at least in the classic passage of Mark 10, Matthew 19. He's not asked about remarriage, he's asked about divorce. He brings in the question of remarriage, and whenever he speaks about it, he always calls it adultery. St. Paul, in his teaching, approaches it in a slightly different way, doesn't call it adultery, but he says it is not an option. Remarriage after divorce is not an option. And if you look on the same page to 1 Corinthians 5b and verses 10 and 11, to the married, I, Paul, give this command, no, not I, but the Lord, a wife must not separate from her husband. But if she does, she must remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. And a husband must not divorce his wife. So, says Paul, in the situation of divorce, only two options are open to the divorcee. Either she, or by implication he, must remain single, or else there must be a reconciliation between the husband and the wife. Now, inevitably, the question arises, why does the New Testament forbid remarriage? Why is it that Jesus calls it adultery to remarry? Why is it that Paul says it is not an option? And the normal assumption amongst both Christians and non-Christians is that it is in some way or other because of the nature of divorce. So an Australian lawyer has written a book on the subject, quite widely, I think it may still be in print, called Divorce, the Unforgivable Sin? And in that title, he encapsulates very clearly what most people assume about the teaching of the New Testament. The assumption is that the reason why Jesus and St. Paul forbid remarriage after divorce is because somehow divorce is a sin which cannot be fully forgiven, which cannot be fully blotted out, and therefore adultery as some, remarriage as some kind of punishment, penalty for the sin of divorce is not permitted to the divorcee. And that same response, that same assumption, can come out in much more angry forms. I, for example, have had a letter in the past from the mother of a woman where I had said that I was not able to marry the daughter to a divorcee, and the mum wrote to me, "Why can you forgive murderers and thieves and not forgive divorcees?" You see again the assumption there that it's because divorcees cannot be forgiven that they may not remarry. In other words, it's because of the nature of divorce. In fact, as Jesus makes quite clear, that assumption is entirely unfounded. It's not because of the nature of divorce that Jesus forbade remarriage, but it is because of the nature of marriage. Now, in the classic passage, and I'd be grateful if you would turn back to that, and this time to page 2, the classic passage of Matthew 10, 1 to 12, with its parallel in Matthew 19, 1 to 12, Jesus was asked a question about divorce. So in Mark, verse 2, some Pharisees came and tested him by asking, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife?" And the parallel question, which we'll look at a little later on, just slightly different in Matthew 19, verse 3, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any and every reason? Now, Jesus refused to answer that question without first going back to the question of marriage. And this is especially clear in Matthew's account. So he's asked the question in verse 3, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any and every reason? And immediately he goes on in verse 4, haven't you read, he replied, that at the beginning the Creator made them male and female and said, for this reason a man will leave his father and his mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. So in other words, he's asked a question about divorce, and he instantly says, don't you know about marriage in God's eyes? And that is equally there in Mark's account. It comes, as it happens, a little bit later in verses 6 and following in Mark 10. Now, in his discussion of marriage in both Matthew and Mark, Jesus makes two points about marriage. First, he says, in marriage, God joins the couple together. So Mark 10, verse 9, therefore, what God has joined together, let man not separate. The identical words in Matthew 19, verse 6. Something which in every modern, anyway, Anglican marriage service words that we use, what God has joined together, let man not separate. Now, it's important, I think, to stress that Jesus teaches this. He teaches that God joins the couple together, of any couple. Jesus makes it quite clear that this is what we call technically, don't we, a creation ordinance. That it predates Moses. In other words, it predates the specifically Israelite legislation, the legislation that is specific to the elect people of God. It predates even Abraham, the calling out of a special people of God. No, Jesus says very clearly that this is what was true, verse 6, at the beginning of creation. And in Matthew, actually, he makes the point twice. Verse 4, at the beginning, the Creator made them male and female. And verse 8, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives because your hearts were hard, but it was not this way from the beginning. So Jesus appeals over the head of Moses and says that God's original creation intention is actually his abiding one. And that therefore God joins together every couple. It doesn't matter whether the couple are Christian or not, God joins them together. It doesn't matter whether they're married in a church or in a registry office, God joins them together. Any couple and every couple is joined together by God. It doesn't even matter if they are a couple who should never have got married in the first place. God respects the decision of a man and a woman, and while on earth it may be a clergyman or a registrar who makes them humanly, as it were, in the eyes of the law, man and wife, it is actually, and much more importantly, God who joins each couple together. So that's the first thing that Jesus says. He's asked a question about divorce. He refers them back to marriage, and he says, in marriage, God joins a couple together. Secondly, in marriage, the two become one flesh. Jesus quotes Genesis 2:24. So this comes in verse 7 of Mark. He says, for this reason, this is quoting directly Genesis 2:24, for this reason a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. And then he adds his own comment, so they are no longer two, but one, or one flesh. That's in verse 8 of Mark, and of course, identically in verse 6 of Matthew 19. I think it's important, too, to stress that he doesn't say they become, so they become no longer two, but one, but they are no longer two, but one. In other words, he is not saying here that when a couple, which is of course true, but it's not what Jesus is saying, that when a couple get married, it's only the beginning of a developing relationship, and that the couple come into the marriage still very much with their own, probably with their own single identity and single way of looking at things, and that as they progress on in their marriage, if it's a healthy marriage, so they come increasingly to think not just of themselves as individuals, but of themselves as a couple. Now, that is true, and those of us who are married know that very well in our own experience, but that is not what Jesus is saying here. He is saying rather that at marriage, they are, in God's eyes particularly, and often in the eyes of those around them, no longer principally two individuals, but principally one entity, a couple. Now, two things follow from these two statements of Christ about marriage. The first is that marriage should not be broken up. To quote again verse 9, therefore what God has joined together, let man not separate. It stands to reason, doesn't it? If God has put his seal on marriage, and not just on marriage in general, but on this marriage and that marriage, on every marriage, if God has put his seal on marriage, then no human being, neither the couple themselves, nor a third party, is to seek to undo the work that God has done. And that is the answer to their original question. The Pharisees asked, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife? And Jesus answers very clearly, no, in the eyes of God. God has joined the couple together. No one is to separate them. Marriages should not be broken up. More importantly, however, Jesus says marriages cannot be broken up. They can be dissolved legally, but they cannot be dissolved in God's eyes. When God joins a couple together, the two have become, they are, one flesh. That cannot be undone. And it is precisely to drive home that point that Jesus goes on to talk about remarriage and calls it adultery. So if you would turn over the page now to page 3. When they were in the house again, the disciples asked Jesus about this. They found his teaching difficult. They wanted to have it explained more fully. And Jesus answered, anyone who divorces his wife and marries another woman commits adultery against her. And if she divorces her husband and marries another man, she commits adultery. So in the two sort of obvious situations that there may be a remarriage, both where a man divorces his wife and remarries, or allowing for the Roman situation where a woman divorces her husband and remarries, Jesus says specifically that that remarriage would be adultery. Now in Greek, as in English, there are two words for extramarital sin. In the normal English translation of the two words, there is fornication, or we would say premarital sex, and adultery, which we would rather more narrowly call extramarital sex. Fornication, where neither party is married, but adultery, a different word in both Greek, the word used here, and in English, adultery is sexual sin where one or both partners are married. So in calling remarriage adultery, Jesus is saying that the divorced partner may have the marriage dissolved in the eyes of the law, but in the eyes of God, the marriage still subsists. And that is why remarriage is adultery, because the marriage is still in existence. And that's made very clear in verse 11 of Mark. Anyone who divorces his wife and marries another woman commits adultery against her. That is, against his first wife. He's still married to her. He commits adultery against her by marrying another woman. It follows then both that a divorcee may not remarry during his or her partner's lifetime, and that a single person may not marry a divorcee. And both of these truths are made very succinctly and clearly, if you turn over the page once more, by Jesus in Luke 16:18. He says, anyone who divorces his wife and marries another woman commits adultery, and the man who marries a divorced woman commits adultery. Why? I want to stress this again because it seems to be so little understood. Not because of the divorcee's divorce, which he or she may have not wanted and may have played little or no part in. For example, a divorced woman may have had her husband simply run off with another woman. So not because of the divorcee's divorce, not because there is some sin in divorce which cannot be forgiven, because to the contrary, the sin of course can be forgiven. And in any case, the divorcee's sin, the particular person that you are talking to, may have been very minimal in the breakup of the marriage, but rather because of the nature of marriage, that God joins a man and woman in marriage into a single unit, which not only cannot, but should not, and not only should not, but cannot, be broken by anything but death. Well, that undoubtedly, and I think really without any serious controversy for those who accept the teaching of Scripture, that undoubtedly is the major position of the New Testament. But clearly we have to face the question of the exception in Matthew, if you would turn back to page 3. And it comes twice, verse 32, down the bottom of the page in Matthew 5. Jesus says, I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife, except for marital unfaithfulness, causes her to commit adultery. And up the top of the page, on the right-hand side, Matthew 19, verse 9, I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife, except for marital unfaithfulness, and marries another woman, commits adultery. Now, I think everyone who has studied this in any depth agrees on two things. Firstly, as we've seen, that the overriding New Testament position is that there should not be remarriage after divorce. And secondly, that the only verse you can really build a case for remarriage where there has been marital unfaithfulness is Matthew 19, verse 9. And in essence, there are two ways of understanding this verse. You can understand it in this way. Anyone who divorces his wife and marries another woman commits adultery, except that it is all right to marry another woman in the case of marital unfaithfulness. In other words, this is essentially a saying about remarriage, forbidding remarriage in most cases, but allowing it in the case of marital unfaithfulness. Or secondly, you can take it in this way. Anyone who divorces his wife and marries another woman commits adultery, except that it is all right to divorce one's wife in the case of marital unfaithfulness. In other words, this is primarily a saying, on the second understanding, about divorce, forbidding divorce, except in the case of marital unfaithfulness. That's the primary emphasis. Now, if this verse is taken in isolation, you just read verse 9, I think you would have to favor interpretation 1. That Jesus is really talking about remarriage, and he's saying that anyone who divorces his wife and marries another woman commits adultery, except that it is all right to marry another woman in the case of marital unfaithfulness. Taken in isolation, that's what it appears to be, a saying about remarriage. The sad thing is that most people who think biblically about this subject do take this verse in isolation, but the verse does not stand alone. Taken in its preceding context, that is verses 1 to 8, it is at least as likely that the second interpretation is correct. After all, Jesus has been asked in verse 3 a question about divorce, and he hasn't until this point really, directly answered that question, or rather, I suppose he has, yes, that's not quite true. He has in verse 6 initially, but he's then challenged about divorce still in verses 7 and 8, and so he is responding still to the question of divorce. So taken with its preceding context, it's at least as likely that the second interpretation, the one allowing divorce but not remarriage, in the case of marital unfaithfulness, is correct. Taken with its other contexts, I think this conclusion is inescapable. And I want to bring you, as I close this particular lecture, three further contexts which force me to that conclusion. First, there is the immediately following context. What is quite clear is that the disciples are very surprised by what Jesus says. So Jesus makes this statement in verse 9, and then verse 10, the disciples said to him, if this is the situation between a husband and wife, it's better not to marry. Now we need to go back a little bit into contemporary Judaism at this point. This whole issue of divorce, not remarriage, but divorce, was a hot potato amongst the rabbis of Jesus' day. There were essentially two schools of thought headed up by two very influential rabbis, Rabbi Hillel and Rabbi Shammai. The Hillelite position was, in essence, that a man could divorce his wife for any reason whatsoever. And in subsequent Jewish literature, slightly later, taking the Hillelite position, it says specifically that if a woman, for example, as my wife did yesterday, burns the toast, then I am perfectly within my rights on that ground alone to divorce her. The Shammaiite school, by contrast, said that only in the situation of sexual sin could a man divorce his wife. So only where there had been some clear marital unfaithfulness could there be a divorce. Now, this, as I say, contemporary with Jesus, was a fiercely debated subject. And when in Matthew 19, verse 3, they asked the question, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any and every reason? They're basically saying, do you line up with Rabbi Hillel or not? Now, quite clearly, they knew that Jesus didn't. Verse 3, some Pharisees came to him to test him. As we see very often in New Testament times, Pharisees didn't really want to know what Jesus thought. They wanted to catch him out. I should really have included verses 1 to 2, which John read for us, because Jesus was cornered on this and asked this question specifically on the territory of the Herod who had married Herodias. In other words, the very man who had had John the Baptist put to death because he challenged the remarriage, both Herod and Herodias, were remarried, both divorced. John the Baptist had been put to death for challenging this marriage. And now Jesus, with his views clearly known as being, as it were, strict on divorce, is being publicly asked this difficult question for him. Now, if his opponents knew that he had a strict view on divorce, presumably his disciples did. Indeed, if the Sermon on the Mount was spoken before Matthew 19, it's certainly several chapters before it in Matthew's account, they've already heard him speak on the subject. Now, it is inconceivable that they should be surprised then if Jesus takes simply a view which was common in his own day, if he agrees with Shammai. No, what stunned them was their understanding that Jesus was saying not no divorce except for marital unfaithfulness, Shammai's position, but no remarriage even when there has been marital unfaithfulness, which really was revolutionary for his day. And that's why they blurt out, if this is the situation between a husband and wife, it's better not to marry. Now look at how Jesus goes on. He doesn't say, no, you've quite misunderstood me. Of course it's fine to remarry, and indeed fine even to remarry, if there has been a situation of marital unfaithfulness. No, on the contrary, Jesus goes on to speak about singleness. Verse 11, he replies to them, not everyone can accept this word, but only those to whom it has been given. For some are eunuchs because they were born that way, others were made that way by men, and others have renounced marriage, or literally have made themselves eunuchs, because of the kingdom of heaven. The one who can accept this should accept this. Now, this is not just general teaching about singleness, which is, again, how it's often understood, because the verse is taken out of its context, it's taken in isolation, but it is specifically teaching about remaining single, that is to say, not remarrying, after divorce. Why? verse 12, because of the kingdom of heaven. That is, because of its moral demands. So the sequence here is, Jesus says this saying in verse 9, the disciples are amazed, verse 10, and Jesus says, absolutely. And there are many who are called to remaining single, or in the image, to making themselves eunuchs, in other words, to renouncing sexual activity, because of the kingdom of heaven. So that's the first context, which forces me to the conclusion that Matthew 19:9 allows divorce in the case of marital unfaithfulness, but not remarriage. Here's a second. If you turn on now to the interpretation of St. Paul, and this is page 4, and verses 10 and 11 of 1 Corinthians 7, the last passage, he says to the married, I give this command, not I, but the Lord, a wife must not separate from her husband. But if she does, she must remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. And a husband must not divorce his wife. Now, Paul here is doing something which is comparatively rare. In fact, it's very rare for him. It's not unique, but it's very rare for him. And that is that he is specifically quoting the teaching of Jesus. I've been spending the whole morning quoting the teaching of Jesus. But I'm sure you've noticed before that St. Paul, perhaps to our surprise, very rarely does that. And yet here he specifically does so. He says in verse 10, this is not I who am speaking, I am passing on to you the teaching of Jesus while he was on earth. Now the normal assumption amongst people commenting on this passage is that because he says categorically, a wife must not separate from her husband, verse 10, and at the end of verse 11, a husband must not divorce his wife. The normal assumption is that Paul knew the tradition of the teaching of Jesus, which comes in Mark and Luke. That is to say that there was no exception in the tradition of Jesus' teaching that he inherited. But that Paul softened Jesus' teaching. So the tradition he inherited is no divorce, but he says to soften this, but, verse 11, if she does divorce, she must remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. Now I find that a totally impossible, not just implausible, but actually impossible explanation. For any of us who know the teaching of Paul, we would know that in his own teaching, he never says, now look, this is what you should do in a certain situation. He frequently says that, but he never goes on to say, but if you disobey what I'm saying here and do something quite different, then this is what to do. It's inconceivable that Paul would speak in that way when he gives his own teaching. Still less so when he has gone out of his way to say that this is not his teaching, no, and clearly in order to give it greater authority, it is the Lord's. Now on the assumption, on the understanding I've just given, what Paul does is this. He's saying, I'm quoting the Lord now, a wife must not separate from her husband. He hasn't even finished his quotation on this assumption. He's going to finish it at the end of verse 11, and a husband must not divorce his wife. He hasn't even finished his quotation of Jesus, and he says, but if you disobey Jesus, then this is what to do. If he wouldn't do it with his own teaching, still less would he do it when he's making a point of saying that this is the teaching of Jesus. But in any case, he tells us quite clearly when he stops quoting Jesus. In verse 10, he says, this is not me speaking, I am quoting the Lord. In verse 12, he says, to the rest I say, now, this is me now, not the Lord. In other words, his quotation of Jesus begins in verse 10 and it ends in verse 12. Well, what do we find then at the beginning of verse 11? We find an exception. within the teaching of Jesus, he is quoting an exception. Surely then, what he is doing is saying, Jesus taught, verse 10, that a wife must not separate from her husband, and Jesus taught that in the one legitimate exception, namely, where there has been divorce for marital unfaithfulness, in that situation, Jesus taught, the woman must remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. In other words, far from Paul knowing the tradition as in Mark and Luke, he knew the tradition in Matthew, he knew the tradition of Jesus which had an exception in it, and he makes abundantly clear his own understanding, an understanding which has the imprimatur of God, because it is in the New Testament, which was that Jesus taught that in the case of legitimate divorce, there should be no remarriage. The two options only open, continuing singleness or else reconciliation. And thirdly, the third context I want to bring to you is the interpretation of the early church. The fathers, from some of the earliest onwards, frequently discuss the question of remarriage. They certainly know and often quote both Matthew 5 and Matthew 19, including the exception clause. They recognize that Christ allowed divorce where there had been marital unfaithfulness. In fact, some early Christian writers say that an adulterous partner must be divorced. They go beyond Jesus' teaching in that. Yet they all, with in the first 500 years or so, only one late exception, a writer called Ambrosiaster, they all either condemn remarriage, giving no exceptions, that's their normal approach, or, in rather fewer examples, specifically say that remarriage is forbidden even when the divorce has been for adultery. So the early church writers, many of them, of course, familiar with Greek in a way that none of us are today because it was their native tongue, all, with this one late exception, understand Jesus to be saying no remarriage, even in the case of marital unfaithfulness. So when Matthew 19:9 is taken in its immediate and wider context, I believe we have to conclude that Jesus is entirely consistent. He saw marriage as God joining a man and woman together into a single inseparable unit. He saw divorce as only allowable where there has been marital unfaithfulness, and he saw remarriage as adultery because the marriage bond is not broken by legal divorce, even on the grounds of marital unfaithfulness, but only by death. Now, I am afraid I've not been as good as my word, because I'd said I would finish at 10. We've got 3 minutes to coffee. I would suggest, that's possible, that we break now and we start with some questions. Is that possible? Yes, please.
Can we take questions, first of all, and confine them to what was said in the lecture that we've just heard? Reg, I see you're anxious to ask something.
Mayor St. Andrew, for a very helpful and clear presentation. I've understood the oddity, in other words, allowing adultery.
Sure.
And what I'd like, I hope it may be helpful, I think obviously not for general discussion, but the areas in what you have said that I would want to look at again. You mentioned divorce as being undesirable, and obviously because it is a result of adultery, it is undesirable. That does not necessarily mean that it is absolutely forbidden, though it has a background of sin. In Deuteronomy 4, the third marriage back to the original husband is detestable, though the second one defiled but is allowed. I think that Moses did actually legislate a procedure. He did want a certificate to be given to the woman so that her status was clear in society for being divorced. The disciples' shock, these are just points really that I would want to think about, because I certainly wouldn't want to follow this up in my own thinking. The disciples' shock, I've always understood to be that adultery is the only way out, and adultery is absolutely unthinkable. It was subject to stoning by death in the Old Testament, and I think their shock could be explained for that reason. I think your argument appeared to be so strong because you left the discussion of the accepted clause to the end. And as that obviously made it very... I'm not saying that was wrong, but it definitely made it stronger. Just two other things. That if there is no remarriage, then is there not perhaps in the New Testament a lack of a compassion that was present in the Old Testament? Namely, that in certain cases... remarriage was allowed. And the other thing which perhaps you might like to respond to, Andrew, is that the meaning of the word divorce, which certainly in English includes the right to remarry, and I had understood that in some of the biblical passages also the normal meaning would have been the right to remarry. Now, obviously, you can't answer all those. I don't want to mess up the whole thing. But those are just points that I, from my point of view, would want to, and certainly will study more closely.
Okay, well, that's about 6 points, and I will try to... I had thought in my own mind that we'd have questions till 5-2 anyway, if we may.
Okay, that's fine.
So let me... I'll have to be very brief, obviously. I hope I've made it clear on your first point that I also believe, in fact, I think it'd be hard to believe anything different, that Jesus does allow divorce in the case of marital unfaithfulness. Specifically, he doesn't mandate it, but he does permit it. So that there are many cases of couples where there has been adultery, where the offended partner is able to work it out with the offending partner, and the marriage continues, and may continue very healthily. So I certainly am not wanting to take away from that permission. I don't incidentally think, as authors often say, that there is a second permission given where there is a non-Christian partner married to a Christian partner, because in 1 Corinthians 7, quite clearly, Paul says, no, in that situation as well there is to be no divorce. All he does say is that the Christian partner need not insist on the retention of the marriage. Now, that's something quite different. It's not saying that here is a second reason why a Christian may initiate divorce proceedings. It is simply a reason why a Christian may acquiesce in divorce proceedings which the other partner initiates. And therefore, there is in Scripture only one legitimate grounds for divorce, and that is marital unfaithfulness. Second, you said that Moses did legislate for remarriage. Well, I don't want to get into a great semantic discussion about this, but I would want to maintain that he didn't. What he did do, as I said right at the outset, was that he assumed the practice, which practice included the granting of a certificate of divorce. And yes, indeed, you are right that that granting of a certificate of divorce was, in part, one imagines, it never says so, in order to protect the woman and to make clear her status within society. And indeed, perhaps, to allow her to remarry. But this is not legislated for. It is merely mentioned in passing in the one piece of legislation which is there, which is actually a piece of legislation to restrict remarriage, admittedly, as I've said, in a certain rather unusual situation. As far as the disciples' shock concern being because adultery was the only reason, well, I can only reiterate what I said, which is that That was not an uncommon view in Jesus' day whatsoever. It was a view which Rabbi Shammai, an influential rabbi, and his school put forward. And I find it unlikely, not impossible, but unlikely, that they expressed such shock when Jesus' hard views must already have been known, and if he was only reiterating what was a commonly held view in his own day. As far as leaving the acceptive clause to the end is concerned, well, I must leave you to decide whether or not that was, as it were, a fair approach. But what I do want to say on that is this. Of course, there can be disagreement on whether the exception clause allows remarriage in the case of marital unfaithfulness. In practice, however, churches find it extraordinarily difficult to have anything except either a no remarriage or an almost all remarriage policy. I speak for the Anglican Church, for example. At the moment, the official Anglican position is that there should be no remarriage in church while the divorcee, you know, while one's divorced partner is still living. This was also the case of the Anglican Church in the United States, where I have served. Legislation was introduced in the United States, as it has been most recently in Ireland within the Anglican Church, or at least it's in the first processes of that, to allow the possibility in some circumstances for there to be a remarriage of divorcees. Once you let the floodgates open a little, everyone goes through. And so you find in this country today, those churches which accept remarriage in any circumstance find it extremely difficult to refuse it in all. Now, this is, of course, a pastoral argument. It is not a biblical argument. But what I'm saying is this. There should be no dispute that the basic New Testament position is remarriage is out. The dispute is whether under certain circumstances it is possible. In practice, churches find it almost impossible to keep to that line, if they take it, that it is possible under certain circumstances only. And so they end up having their position as we remarry divorcees. When very clearly the New Testament position, the fundamental position is, we don't. And to concentrate exclusively on the exception clause, I think, takes away from the general thrust of the Bible's teaching. You've had two other points. Let me try and deal with them quickly. You say, if we're saying there's no remarriage, then we lack the very compassion that the Old Testament had as part of its understanding. I hope that we don't lack compassion, and I'll obviously come on to speak about that in my second lecture. But I think we have to recognize that the New Testament does stand over against the Old Testament as having a more rigorous position. It's the Pharisees who say, well, but how about Moses? Didn't he allow this? Which is, in a sense, exactly, I think, what you're saying. Jesus replies, for your hardness of heart, this was allowed, but from the beginning, and by implication not now as well, in fact not just by implication, he says it clearly, this is not God's will. So Jesus actually quite clearly revokes a permission which the Old Testament, or the Mosaic legislation, granted. And if that is lack of compassion, I think we must lay it at Jesus' door rather than mine, if I may put it like that. Finally, you say that doesn't the word divorce allow the right to remarry? Well, I would want to say yes, it does in the eyes of the law. But Jesus specifically in his teaching differentiates between what the law allows and what he himself and by behind him God allows. And he quite clearly says, I mean, there can be no argument about this, that at least in the majority of cases, to remarry after legal divorce is adultery. And therefore, legal divorce does not, in God's eyes, open the way to remarriage, at least, at the very least, in the majority of cases.
Point number seven.
The answer to this might be listen to my next lecture.
Right.
I was married and divorced my wife for adultery in my teens, got married again 17 years ago, and became a Christian about 13 years ago. And it's always been a great comfort to me to think, well, there's this exception clause. So I've got no reason to reject your exposition, but I found your exposition very convincing. What then?
Do you mean, what do I say to someone like you?
Yes, what
right,
then?
Right. Well, now, I'm very glad to thank you for asking the question. What I want to say to someone like you is essentially this. Let me start by saying what I think that Christ is not asking you to do. I think he's not asking you to do two things. Firstly, I think he's not asking you to say, my present marriage is a disaster. Because we very frequently get into situations, into relationships, into obligations and so on, which we were mistaken in getting into, and yet which God meets us in, blesses us in, and indeed even blesses us through. At any given point in time, there is a course of action which is God's will for me. If I, either because, like you, I'm not even at the time thinking about what God's will is, or because I am a disobedient Christian, take another course of action, another decision which leads me down a certain road, I am so grateful that God doesn't say, Andrew Corns, because you didn't take that decision and go on that road, which is the only road I can meet you and bless you on, you have now put yourself completely beyond the pale and beyond my blessing. No, God is much more gracious and in a way much more flexible than that, so that we constantly take mistaken and even sinful decisions which direct our life in a certain way, and yet God continues to meet us and bless us in them. So he is not saying to you, you are to regard your marriage, your second marriage, as a disaster. On the contrary, to thank him for it, to thank him for how he's blessed you in your new wife, and in the ways that he's used you together, is entirely appropriate. Secondly, I do not believe that Christ is asking you to renege on that second marriage, to say, I shouldn't have married in the first place, therefore, and it's the therefore that I think is the erroneous part of that line of argument, I should now separate from my second wife. Because you have entered into a marriage covenant with your second wife. Now, for the reasons that I've said in my first lecture, I think that had you understood the teaching of Jesus, you shouldn't have done so, but you have. And it would be adding insult to injury, as it were. It would simply be committing a second evil than to repudiate a wife to whom you have made solemn marriage vows. So that's what I'm saying negatively. Now let me say some things positively, even though they're not particularly perhaps welcome things. What am I saying? I am saying, I think, that the logic of Christ's position is that you need to say, this was something which, at the time, had I understood Jesus' teaching, I shouldn't have done. And secondly, that you have a continuing relationship. Now, it cannot, of course, be, as it were, a full marital relationship with your first wife. I'm not suggesting that you invite her into your marital home, but you do have, in God's eyes, a continuing relationship with her, which actually in God's eyes is a marital relationship, though it can't be expressed fully, and that it is incumbent on you to be reconciled to her. And here we are coming right into my second lecture, and I think I probably should finish at this point. I'm sorry, but they're very big questions I was asked. It is incumbent on you to be reconciled to your first wife to the extent that that is possible. In other words, to be able to forgive and to reestablish communications to the extent that that is possible, both in terms of her response to you and, of course, taking into account your commitment to your second wife.
Yes.